Hello, everyone. I'm your host, March Twisdale, and you're listening to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose here on our Island Zone, Voice of Vashon, 101.9 FM. Today, I'm grateful to have Edward Struzik joining me on the show. Edward, thank you for joining me. How are you doing today?
I'm doing just fine. Thanks for having me on.
Yes, absolutely. So, folks, in 2018, we had Edward join us on the show, and you outlined some of this in your book, Firestorm, How Wildfire Will Shape Our Future. Can you please tell everyone a little bit about yourself and your book?
Well, I'm a fellow at the Institute for Energy and Environmental Policy at Queen's University in Canada, and I'm also a regular contributing writer to Yale Environment 360, which is produced by the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. And I've been interested in fire since I saw firsthand a really big one in 2003 and was involved in watching the firefighters deal with that fire.
Wow. So which one was that in 2003? Where were you?
I was in Kootenay National Park, just in British Columbia, near the U.S. border there, and it was a fire that did not get a lot of attention, but it burned very big, very hot. It's not a well-populated park. Not a lot of people go there.
Is that where the white bears are?
No,
okay,
no.
Good. Yeah,
you're, that's a little further west.
Okay.
It's a mountainous park right next to Banff National Park.
Okay.
Yeah, it joins Banff National Park, and that fire just about got into Banff. And
wow.
It was very, very close. The firefighters did some amazing, not-by-the-book things to prevent that to get into Banff. And had it got into Banff, it would have been, I think, really quite catastrophic. I have only the greatest admiration for wildfighters, both on the ground and in the air, and, of course, the those that jump out of planes to deal with fire. Because it's if you're on the front lines of it, it's surreal. You're breathing in heavy smoke. Many firefighters, you know, they're in very hot suits, and it's very cumbersome. And the fires move in very unpredictable ways, especially in the mountains. They race upwards. That's why it's kind of a special case scenario when you're fighting fire in the mountains.
Right. I'm assuming you're going to have different flows of wind that are going to go up this or that canyon in a way you may not be able to predict, but there's that arena of behavior that is predictable. And then you were telling me earlier when we were talking in advance over email that there are a bunch of sort of very unusual types of fire generated weather patterns. Go ahead and explain a bit about that, because it sounds like we are taking an already very challenging situation, and now we're moving it up into a level where predictability is becoming almost impossible.
Yeah, there's several things going on. One of them is that you have these slow-moving thunderstorms that don't produce a lot of rain and produce a lot of lightning. We're seeing these lightning events that are absolutely off the charts. The one that really was a head spinner was one in Alaska. The storm moved across central Alaska through the boreal forest there for 5 days, produced very little rain, but shot out 62,000 bolts of lightning and triggered 286 fires during that time. And it's fortunate that, you know, it was a largely unpopulated area. You can imagine if something, a thunderstorm like that, coming across places that are much more populated. That's one example. The other example that we're seeing are these, what they call these fire thunderstorms. Essentially, a fire can create so much heat and energy that it produces its own thunderstorm, even on a blue sky day. And that cloud of smoke can go right through the troposphere into the stratosphere, and it produces its own thunder and its own lightning. Some people in eastern Washington will know about this because there was one very spectacular one in August 2017, and that smoke from that pyro CB got all the way to Greenland and the high Arctic of Canada. It was detected by scientists there, so you can imagine just how powerful that was. And it was accompanied by four others that occurred in just north of the border in British Columbia, all within a five-hour period. And these thunderstorms are really, these pyro CBs are pretty remarkable. I don't know if you remember the Fort McMurray fire in the oil sands country in 2017,
which
resulted in the evacuation of 88,000 people.
Yeah, wiped out of town, didn't it?
Yeah, it nearly burned the entire town. Everybody had to get out at the very last minute. But that fire produced a pyro CB that shot out lightning 20 miles away from the fire front and ignited a cluster of fires 20 miles away from the fire front. So you can, you know, it's kind of dragons in the forest. If you're a firefighter, and I know I've talked to several of them about this, is that how do you deal with that? Because it's totally unpredictable in nature. You don't know where that lightning is going to go. And when you get the amount of lightning that we're now seeing in some of these storms, it just adds up to a nightmare. And we're seeing these lightning events progressively moving in more intensely and farther north. In places that we really don't see that kind of activity happening before. And apparently CBs used to be kind of confined to the boreal forest of Canada, but, you know, Washington State is seeing them, Texas has seen them, Portugal and Spain has seen them, Argentina has seen them. In the last few years, we're beginning to see really these huge energy pulses all around the world.
The perfect storm.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. Not humorous, but, you know. So 3 years ago, you were talking at that time about, like, an entire century of mismanagement. And before that, like, you had deforestation, then you had reforestation, then you had stop all fire forestation. And so we ended up creating this moment where there was a lot of kindling out there in the forest. So one specific question here for local folks is about 5 years ago, we had the really big fire. Then we had another year and another year. I think we had 3 years in a row here in the Pacific Northwest of just me getting out masks in the middle of summer and wearing masks, and our air quality was like the worst in the world, worse than China. Then last summer, there weren't like any fires close enough in this area to affect us. And I'm wondering, is there any chance that we sort of burned through a century worth of bad forestry management, and that now we have a chance to manage better going forward, and then maybe some of our vulnerability was sort of like reduced? Or is that just an imaginary idea of mine?
Well, I think it's a start. I think that we're going to be facing a lot of problems for a very long time. Not so much that we've mismanaged the forest. I think it's more that we really hadn't come to grips with the fact that fire is, you know, part of the natural landscape, and we were just so good at putting out fires that we kind of created this artificial environment where we produced a lot more old trees, where Mother Nature was trying to produce a lot of younger trees, which are more resilient to disease and to fire as well. And I think in this case, the mismanagement was the fact that the decision makers just weren't listening to the scientists for a very long time, saying, we've got to let some areas burn. But one of the big problems is that we are going into these forests not prepared to deal with the fires. I've continued to see it. I've been invited to many of these forested communities to talk. People tour me around, and I see that they're still building wood houses with cedar-shake shingles in a heavily forested environment. And
we were talking about that, the cedar shingles. Right, so people on Vashon Island and anyone who's listening to this show anywhere, if you're going to redo your roof, don't put cedar shingles on the roof.
Yeah, and, you know, the way we landscape our property as well is that you know, ornamental junipers and cedars are very attractive, but they burn very nicely as well.
Because they're very oily, right?
They're very oily.
Yep.
And we do other things that I think the Fort McMurray fire demonstrated very clearly. The one thing that was real handicap for the firefighters on the ground was they kept hearing these explosions all around them. They couldn't figure out what it was, and it turned out to be the barbecue propane tanks that were, you know, sitting on the wooden deck.
Right.
And they would, things would get so hot that they would explode, and then they would light up the deck, and then the deck would light up the house. And so it became, you know, this terrible dance in the street, trying to run to one explosion to another, these pops that kept coming up.
Okay, so it's 2020. And the entire planet just celebrated, if you're in the Northern Hemisphere, your primary winter holiday. If you're in the Southern Hemisphere, it was summer. And the New Year. And everyone's sitting around basically listening to the fire alarms blasting their way across Australia. We feel helpless. We feel horrified and deeply sad based upon all the ecological devastation and the wildlife suffering in particular. Screens all over the planet have been, you know, awash in this terrible event going on in Australia. Can you go ahead and help us from the perspective of an expert in this field who is not tied to any political or business or corporate influences within Australia?
Australia is in the front lines of a climate change scenario where it's getting hotter, the landscape's getting drier, and producing a lot more kindling for fires to burn. You also have a situation where we've got more people, like you have throughout the Northern Hemisphere, living, working, and playing in these areas that are very combustible. And I think the third thing is that people have to really understand just the formula for a fire. You don't need much to create a fire, but if you increase the temperature by, say, 1.2 degrees, you get 12% more lightning. If we have a summer that is 1 degree Celsius warmer, you're going to get 12% more lightning in areas which are prone to lightning. So you get 12% more chance that lightning is going to cause a fire. But we're also seeing now temperature increases in summertime in the fire season of up 2, 3, and sometimes even 4 degrees. So multiply that, and you see that lightning becomes a much bigger problem than it was, say, 10, 20, or 30 years ago. And combine that with the fact that people also start fire in accidental and stupid ways, it results in a formula that we're now seeing in Australia, where we have a firefighting strategy that was designed for something that was occurring in the 1950s and the 1960s.
Right.
We made some improvements then, but basically we are still in that fire engine mode, using a lot of tools that just aren't sufficient to be able to deal with fires that burn very big. And Australia is, unfortunately, one of the places that is really, really getting hotter and hotter, and it's all because of climate change. And you have a government there that just refuses to accept that that is one of the factors that's going on. They're trying to blame it on other things.
I think right now Australia is like the number one coal exporter in the world, but it also seems a little bit shallow to suggest that Australia can actually solve its problem, because it can't. It's part of a global problem.
Oh, it certainly is. There's no question about it. And I think they are an example for the rest of us, as is California, that this isn't just a localized problem. It is a global problem, and everybody has got to do their part if we're going to slow this down. We're not going to stop it in its tracks. But I think we can, at least for the future generations, slow it down to the point where their world is more habitable than it would be if we do have a 2 to 3 degree increase in warming, because under that scenario, which is a fairly conservative scenario by the end of the century, we're going to have a tripling, possibly a tripling of fire area burned worldwide. And including the United States. And that's a pretty frightening scenario when you think about it. Do you think about the smoke that Washington State has endured, that kind of, do we want to spend our summers with masks on or staying indoors and not being able to see the mountaintops? That's beginning to happen now, and it's only going to get worse because there's, I haven't seen one projection which says that things are going to ease off a little bit.
There may be some people who are just sort of nodding their heads and saying, no, no, it, there's nothing to worry about. But I think personally that most people are sort of on the edge of panic. Awareness is at the point where people are starting to feel itchy inside of their skin. They know there's a very specific problem. It really needs to be dealt with, and it's not being dealt with. So there's a book that you may have heard of. It's called Drawdown.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So for folks out there, I think especially young people, because as the middle age and baby boomer generation sits around and flails and wails and worries and gets anxious and talks about the end of the world, we forget that by doing so, we are sending this message to children, teenagers, and very young adults that they basically have no hope. So we might think we're stressed out, but imagine what they're feeling. And Drawdown is this book that collects from around the world, from the basically agreed upon scientific community, what are the top, I think, 100 things that you can invest your life, your time, and energy in that are proven to be an effective part of the solution. And the idea of Drawdown is it's the time when the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere begins to decline on a year-to-year basis. There is still the potential, I think it's by like 2060, we could potentially achieve the moment of drawdown and begin to start going in the other direction, but only if we make the right choices along the way.
Yeah, and we got to start doing it sooner rather than later.
As in yesterday.
Yeah.
When you talk about causes of fire, there was a really unfortunate thing that was put out there pretty early. And it was this idea that people were running around in Australia starting fires. And what I noticed in social media is that when the topic of what was going on in Australia came up, there would be some people who would say in sort of a crass, irritated way, yeah, well, maybe they shouldn't be starting those fires. It was almost like a way of no longer feeling compassion or empathy, because it hurts so much to feel the compassion and empathy. It's easier to blame these people than to continue to feel sad for their suffering.
Yeah, I think it is exaggerated, and quite honestly, I think it's used as an excuse not to address what the real problem is, and that is climate change and the way we actually live in these highly vulnerable areas. People do start fires, but people generally, the arsonists that they're talking about really aren't the problem. Not in Australia. The problem is that we're not just we just aren't doing enough in a realistic, comprehensive way to learn to live with fire, so that it's no longer our master; it becomes our servant.
Okay, and how would it serve us?
Well, fire is good. I mean, it, you know, trees reach an age of maturity. And before we were here on the landscape, Europeans, for example, before we were here, indigenous people lit fires. They lit fires in all over the United States and on the Great Plains because, number one, it created new grass so that the buffalo would come in and they would be able to hunt buffalo. Under a really thick canopy, berries don't grow very well, so that it allowed berries to flourish. They had an intimate relationship with the landscape, and a lot of the first geographers that came through, Lewis and Clark, David Thompson, were horrified by what they saw. They couldn't understand why they were burning a beautiful forest. And I think it was just the experience of living on the land for thousands of years and seeing what lightning would do and how quickly a forest would regenerate falling lightning. It's sort of a tricky area that I'm getting into now, is because we're not in a normal lightning situation now, as I described earlier. We're
right.
Getting a lot more lightning because of climate change. And so we've got to calibrate this to try to understand how we can manage the forest a lot better. And I don't really have the answers to that.
I don't think
anybody does, because we've really not invested enough in wildfire science. President Trump has reduced the budget for the U.S. Forest Service to deal with these.
So you said earlier younger forests were sort of like historically the norm, and yet most of us have this romantic notion of the historical past being sort of like, I guess, the way Tolkien described, you know, the old world, you know, and giant trees everywhere. And of course, we know that when the Europeans came into this continent and washed across, what did they encounter? They have all these pictures of these giant redwoods that, you know, are 25 foot in diameter or whatever. Most of us, I think, have an impression that in the past, forests were full of giant old trees. And yet earlier and just now, you've suggested that the real history is that the forest would mostly be full of younger trees because of more frequent fires that would sort of cleanse the land in a way and regenerate and restart. Try to help me and our listeners put those two things together. What is fiction? What is fact? How is it we have 800-year-old trees and yet supposedly the natural way of things is fire? Explain that.
Well, we need those trees because, you know, not all the forest burns, especially on the wet west coast. And so one of the reasons why you have trees that are out that old, 800 years old, is partly because of the weather and the climate, a very damp climate. Fire was a factor in regenerating those old forests. And many of these cedars and spruce trees, the only way that you can open up the seeds really is with heat. Birds can do it, squirrels can do it, but not enough to create a young tree. And you really need to clear out the old trees to some extent, as Mother Nature would do. And I'm hoping that people don't think that I'm saying that we've got to go out there and clear cut, because I think that's not the solution.
I'm not hearing that.
No.
Okay.
But some people do when I say that, and clear cutting, I think, is really not the answer to it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that what fire does is what you want is a mix of old forest and also different kinds of tree that grow up from a burned out area. You start with the grasses and then the shrubs, and you have aspen, some of the hardwoods that grow, and eventually the coniferous trees take over and shade out everything below.
Right.
And that's why the indigenous people burn, because they saw that there just wasn't enough berries for, say, bears to eat. There wasn't a lot of root vegetables that they could harvest. So they tried to mimic what Mother Nature would do.
Well, and I'm assuming we have some research into the thinking behind what they were doing, but also I think that it simply made it easier to travel through forested regions like on the East Coast and stuff when the, quote, pilgrims first arrived. You know, I believe there was just an entire network of easy-to-walk trails basically all over the relatively thickly forested landscape because the fires were keeping sort of the underbrush down.
Right.
Right.
The big difference, though, when the Pilgrims and the Puritans came, was that they came during what we call the Mini Ice Age, around the 1600 to 1850, where things were a heck of a lot wetter. It was just this period in our climatic history where things were colder and wetter, and we did not see a lot of fire on the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And so those people who came, you know, from Great Britain, where you don't have a lot of big fires, didn't see them until around 1825, where there was a massive fire in Maine called the Miramichi Fire. It was one of the biggest fires in North American history. And people were absolutely paralyzed because they just did not know what to do. They'd mm-hmm. never seen anything like it. There was no record of it. And that was when our attitude started to develop, that fire was a demon, because we started to see, as we got out of that little ice age, we started to see things getting hotter and drier and then a lot more fire. And we just didn't have the expertise or the know-how to deal with them until the big burn in Montana and Idaho in 1910, which killed a lot of people and came at a time where there was a lot more publicity around these fires and really changed the way we deal with fire. That's when the U.S. Forest Service decided that every fire would be put out at 10 a.m. the next day if possible. We invested an awful lot from around 1910 right up until the 1990s in ways of dealing with fire. I deal with it in my book. It goes from everything from using homing pigeons to send messages, heliographs to send messages. We had fire boats. We got very inventive. And then became a scientific exercise to, you know, measure just how dry the landscape was, the prospects, you know, predicting lightning events. We got very good, and we started to be able to deploy firefighting resources in those areas that were most vulnerable.
Right, exactly. Transportation infrastructure and whatnot.
Yeah, we've got water bombers now. We've got chemicals that we use, which aren't good, but are very effective. Aren't good for the ecosystem, but are very effective at dealing with fires.
So we have a little ice age followed by a change, and I know this is oftentimes for people who feel that the environmental changes to the climate today would have happened anyways, regardless of human activity, sort of it doesn't really matter, I think, whether we believe that it's being caused by us or not right now in 2020 on planet Earth. Regardless of that cause, what you're basically saying is that we still need to upgrade, alter, shift, expand, and grow our capacity for responding.
Yeah, we do, but I think we also have to be cognizant of the fact that we are driving this heat. We're the main drivers. Mother Nature is probably playing some role, but it's very clear from all the scientific evidence that the amount of greenhouse gas that we're putting into the atmosphere is the principal reason why we're seeing the planet heat up so quickly.
Sure, and I personally agree with you, but I also have, you know, friends and family members who do not. And so for the many people on planet Earth, if they don't want to change their mind on that topic, I think that it's important that we still be able to give them the message that, okay, fine, you want to disagree on the cause, okay, but we have the reality in front of us and we need to figure out how to deal with what's going on.
I agree. That's definitely part of the equation. How many more summers do you want to endure where you're not going to be able to see the mountaintops and where you're going to have a gas mask on or it's not going to be pleasant to go out for a run? We're seeing that with increasing frequency. I think most people in your area grew up and really didn't experience that kind of thing.
Nope.
And now it's happening in places like Washington State. You just wouldn't figure that it would happen. Just imagine what it's like living in Australia or in Southern California.
Yeah. I'm not sure I want to imagine what it would feel like to be right now in some of the areas of Australia that are being devastated. So let's talk a little bit more about California, blamed on actually arsonists and then PG&E.
The infrastructure is not new infrastructure. It's old infrastructure that hasn't been updated. And the arcing, that the sparks that comes from the arcing, tends to come out of lines that have been old lines that have been weakened, and in areas where the forest or the brush hasn't been cleared around the power lines. And so when you have these Santa Ana winds, wind events driving through and knocking down some of these weakened posts and wires, and the sparking takes place, that's essentially what happened in California. Many some California communities have long ago started burying their power lines to avoid having this kind of threat, this sparking that takes place, or ordered utilities to do a much better job of making their power lines more resilient. And
okay.
That's what's been happening in California, and it's happening in other places of the world, but we've really noticed it mostly in California.
There was a discussion, I think, they were playing around with the idea of, I guess PG&E, I think right now, is a privately owned company.
Yeah, PG&E is now in bankruptcy. And
right.
I think there's...
An idea that the state may actually sort of take it on.
Well, the state has thrown out that possibility because everybody's wondering about the viability of the company in its current state. It has, you know, tens of billions of dollars of liabilities that it's facing.
Right.
And the only way of really covering those costs is increasing the rates which people pay. California has just created a $21 billion fund to help deal with those issues. From what I understand, it's going to cost a heck of a lot more. So it's a financial nightmare that's going on right now there.
Yeah, but they can't blame all the fires in California suddenly poof all on PG&E. There's also natural starting fires, right?
Oh yeah, there's definitely natural fires that have started naturally and innocently. You know, the fire in Australia, one of the big fires near Canberra, was started in a national park by a helicopter.
Yeah, I heard about that.
So, you know, you can
understand. And it was actually helping firefighters. It was a firefighting support helicopter. I think it was a light on the bottom of the helicopter somehow like flared or something and lit the grass underneath the helicopter on fire. And then if it then flies off, what I don't understand is why they weren't able to immediately put out that fire. There were obviously humans on the ground standing there, right? Like, how did that happen?
Well, it can happen very quickly. That's the problem. When you have an extremely dry brush or forest, and you have a lot of strong wind, those embers from those, from the brush, the bushfires, in a very strong wind scenario can travel up to 3 miles.
Right.
It's very difficult to contain it in that situation. I remember I gave a talk at UCLA a couple of years ago, and the fire chief for the city of Los Angeles was there, and after my talk, there was a question and answer session in which he kindly answered questions from the audience, and this one woman stood up and said, "What do you need, chief, to be able to prevent this from happening again? Like, how much money, how many resources do you need so that we don't get into this situation again?" And he said, "Ma'am, the only thing that's going to stop a Santa Ana wind-driven fire is the Pacific Ocean. all we can do really is to," you know, he didn't discount that they need more resources, but he said in a situation like that, once a fire gets going, really it's like a hurricane. It's a meteorological event that really can't be stopped if the wind is driving it.
Right.
So the best thing that that they can do is maybe they can kind of steer it another direction or slow it down. But if those winds continue to blow and it's hot, there's no rain in the forecast, it really is the Pacific Ocean that's going to stop that fire.
Right. I think a lot of people who live in this region, at least, where, you know, you could go out and spend 3 hours trying to start a fire and fail.
Yeah.
It's a little hard for us to fully appreciate sometimes just how dry. And also, when you look at Australia, it's not just a matter of dryness. It's not just a matter of the wind and just a matter of fuel. It's a matter of the type of fuel we're dealing with. I mean, the gum trees, you know, it's like a lot of them just explode the same, you know, because they're so oily.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, tea tree oil, eucalyptus oil, right? You know? So, it's pretty fascinating.
But then again, you know, you look at where you are, you're just south of the desert area of British Columbia. which has an awful lot of fire. And so you're subjected, I know, to a lot of the smoke that happens in those areas.
Right.
And so you're not immune to what's going on. And
no, we had those 3 summers in a row. The one summer was, man, Eastern Washington was insane. Yeah. I mean, I knew people who had property out there, and, you know, there were just all these stories. It moved so fast. It burned so deep. And it was incredible. The next year, I think, was Oregon, maybe. Another year was British Columbia. Like, each of those areas was, like, a primary source of smoke for 3 years in a row, for weeks on end. Honestly, I don't know how everyone else on the island or in this region felt. Claustrophobic. That's what it is. It just started to make me feel on edge.
Yeah. Well, look at Williams Flat Fire in Washington just this past summer. It was almost 50,000 acres.
Really?
Eastern Washington.
Yeah.
That was the big fire. I think that was your largest fire last summer. And we're just going to see that happening more and more often.
So there's, real quick, we'll touch one more on something global here. I saw something on Facebook which I thought was really lovely, and I went ahead and shared it forward. It was just a simple map of Australia, the outline, placed on top of the continental U.S., basically the same size. And I think a lot of times people underestimate the size of Australia. We have a hard time, you know, it's just this island way down there, you know, and we sort of get it and we sort of don't. And there was just fires everywhere. And I thought, you know, imagine if in the United States of America in August of, you know, 2020 or something, you literally had like all the fires of the Pacific Northwest, all the California fires happening at the same time, and happening in the middle of the country, and happening on the East Coast. Like, the whole country's on fire. What's going on psychologically for the people who live in Australia?
Well, yeah, I think we've seen it in the news reports that the, you know, people, their heads are spinning. They've got some serious mental health issues that are now arising. People don't know this about the Fort McMurray fire, but I think 15% of the 80,000 people who evacuated ended up having to get mental health treatment because, you know, many of them lost their homes. It was a traumatic experience. The kids went through a lot of trauma, you know, being bundled up in the middle of the night and driving through flames for several hours, for 6 or 8 hours to get to the next city that could house them. And you make a good point, because we haven't really had a situation here now in the United States and Canada where we've had a kind of a coast-to-coast fire challenge. Most year it's confined to, it happens mostly in the West. That's a given. But the East does burn, and we're seeing now the East is burning more than it has in the past. So what happens if we have a year where the East burns big, the central part, Oklahoma burns big, and California burns big? We've had these scenarios before where in 2003, which was a really big fire season, where firefighters had to go into triage. They didn't have enough water bombers and helicopters and personnel to be able to put out all, to deal with all of the fires. And so, that, I think, is going to be the scary scenario here in North America, is that what if California, Washington, Idaho, Montana, British Columbia, Alberta, and parts of Maine start burning big, you know, burn big
at the same time.
Things are happening now in Australia. And that's going to be a frightful situation, because there is only so many resources out there to be able to deal with something like that.
Well, and the interesting thing is that it's sort of like being a firefighter historically, when there wasn't quite as much international travel, would have been a seasonal thing. And now, especially if you're a professional firefighter, given that they can throw you in a plane and ship you somewhere, you know, when we had really bad fires, people from Australia came up to help. Well, that was their winter. They were supposed to be getting a break, recovering. So, you know, if you become a firefighter, it's going to become sort of a year-round deployment, you know, way of living, and I think that we're going to run into exhaustion. I think Australia, if I'm correct, has a lot of this thing that they call volunteer firefighting, which it makes sense to have people skilled up so they can step up to help locally. But I'm not sure that relying on a majority volunteerism is going to actually cut it.
No, and most volunteer firefighters are focused on structural issues. They're the local firefighters that deal with fires in a small town. They're, by and large, not trained to be able to deal with a big bushfire or forest fire. That's a special skill. We do have some, many of them are volunteers, but we don't, I think this is why we have to have a continental wildfire strategy put into place, not just, you know, California and Washington State developing their own strategies, but right. One that becomes a national strategy. We do share resources, but in ways that are still fairly primitive. As many firefighters will tell me that those bringing in people who have never fought a fire in a mountain landscape is sometimes more of a headache than help.
Oh, I could imagine so. Not to mention it could be considered, it's like they're going to make deadly mistakes as well.
Yeah.
There's an article in The Guardian that came out on January 16th. So that was, I think, just like, you know, a week ago-ish. It's titled Grief, Frustration, Guilt. Guilt. The bushfires show the far-reaching mental health impacts of climate change. Loss of property, hazardous air, and reduced food security has transitioned into mass eco-anxiety. But the guilt piece. I was so grateful to whoever it was that made the decision to both choose to, and the people who allowed it to happen, because media oftentimes loves to filter the information that is expressed to the world. I was really glad they started talking about the animals when they came out with, you know, half a billion animals are going to be killed. And now they're like, yeah, we're looking at a billion animals that have been burned to death in the last month and a half. Because every time there's been a fire that I've been aware of up here in the Pacific Northwest, California, wherever, you know, the Amazon was being burnt on purpose, talk about purposeful fires. Everyone in my media locally, it's like, how many houses and how many people were hurt? And frankly, I'm just sitting there like, I don't care. I'll be honest. I love those people. I have compassion for their suffering. But, you know, the 450 houses and the two people who died and the 5,000 who have to relocate, that compared to all of the deer and the bats and the squirrels and all the animals that can't outrun the fire, that can't escape, and that all get burned to death, or, you know, I was really glad they went there. But talk about the guilt.
Well, we're, you know, I mean, you make a good point, but the good situation in the United States and Canada, unlike the situation in Australia, is that we still have a landscape where there are a lot of wetlands from which those animals can escape to. There are these refuges. Mm-hmm. The problem is we're beginning to drain. We've been draining them for urban development and for other purposes, and they're disappearing very quickly. So we're probably going to see a lot more carnage of wildlife in big fire events in the future, because there won't be any place for those animals to go to.
Right.
One of the things I told you earlier about in the Kootenai Fire in British Columbia was there was this historic cabin that the National Park Service was compelled to try to protect during this really intense fire. So they were constantly spraying it and the forest all around it with water. Mm-hmm. And I got to stay there one night. I was stationed there with the wildfire fighters, and it was really quite remarkable, because all of the birds and many of the animals that otherwise would have got killed by those flames, mm-hmm, all came to this one spot, instinctively understood, you know, sensed it in some way. And so it was really quite magical. It was kind of like a Garden of Eden, in which, mm-hmm, the birds, they were all over the place. And, of course, there was a lot of water, and it was a lot cooler. And moose came in, and bears came in. And it was all like we were all hunkering down together until this trouble ended. And I think that's what wetlands are that's their importance
right.
in a forested environment.
Right. That's such a great point. Of course. Absolutely. And I would imagine wetlands are typically devastated when you have forestry practices such as the old clear cutting, you know, ideas and stuff, and then you end up rerouting your rivers, and so humans go in, sort of like reorganize the infrastructure, alter stuff around, and then you've eliminated some of the forest resiliency.
Yep. I say bring back the beaver to California.
Oh, gosh, I love beavers. I love beavers. They're so amazing. And break down the dams and let the river flood sideways. You know,
yeah, we've really got to, you know, restore our wetland ecosystem, because I think this is one way, a natural way of making our forests more resilient to fires and the animals that live in them more resilient to fires.
Right. Whereas
you
in
know,
Australia,
because they'll stop.
Was different.
If you have a big wetland, every firefighter will tell you they've got maps to show where the wetlands are and the fire's heading there. They know they don't have to put anybody there or any mm-hmm. resources there, because that's going to stop the fire in its tracks.
Right. That's like internal Pacific Ocean.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. But Australia didn't have that, and Kangaroo Island didn't have that. And things are really pretty bad down there. So do you, off the top of your head, or I think you mentioned you have, let's see, you have some friends and people you know who are down there. Is there anything you can suggest for people listening right now who want to know that if they take an action, it's going to be effective at long-term aid, perhaps, to what's going on in Australia? Any thoughts around that?
Yeah, you know, I know that there's a lot of aid organizations that are in need of both money and support in a number of ways. And I think that if you just look, you could easily find them on the Internet, organizations like the Red Cross, which can provide immediate help. They're well-publicized, and this is an ongoing problem. You know, it's amazing. We're really just at the beginning of the Australian fire season.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
And unless the weather patterns change, it's going to get worse. We're going to see a lot more of this. And so people are going to need help. And so I encourage people to try to find a way of getting involved.
Yeah. And, you know, like, and in a way, not to use a bad pun, but it's sort of like putting out fires. You know, I mean, that's the other problem, is if we run around just trying to put out the little fires or the huge, ginormous fires as they happen, I think our resources can get spread thin to the point of ineffectiveness in the long term. What type of legislation do you think people should be encouraging, seeking, demanding, or looking for?
Well, I think there's so many. I think we've really got to address the climate change situation. That's number one. But I also think we've got to start having better building codes for people that move into forested areas. The example that we gave earlier is that building a house with cedar shingles and ornamental cedars and junipers surrounding the house is just a recipe for disaster.
Right.
It takes away from firefighting resources, because people have to be protected, and so it takes some people away from the front lines.
There's that piece, too, when they say, could you please, you know, leave? Could you please go somewhere else for a while? Because we don't know what's going to happen. And then people go, oh, well, I like my house a lot. I'm going to stay here. I'm going to turn on my hoses and I'm going to defend my house. Okay, I get it. You love your house. I actually really deeply respect that. But now you've become a pinpoint on that map of a human being who makes all the firefighting efforts sort of go, oh, darn, we've got humans over there still. So when you leave, aren't you actually helping the effort to shut down the fire by pulling yourself out so they can really focus where they need to focus?
Yeah, I think you are. I sympathize with those people because many of them, you know, the local firefighting resources are miles and miles away, and so they tend to want to deal with it on their own, but then they also become a liability for firefighters. I think we've got to do more of what Texas is doing. If they tell you to evacuate, they have laws basically saying you got to get out of there because
right.
we don't want you to be another headache for us.
Right.
And we're starting to see this discussion emerge a lot more. I know a lot of the more traditional people still think that you can stay and defend. But I mm-hmm. think that now that we're seeing these fighters burning so big, so hot, in such unpredictable ways, that you've really got to be skilled and you've really got to have it planned out well.
And you have to be lucky, to be honest. If you're unlucky, no matter what you do as a person standing there with your hose, you're just not going to succeed.
Yeah, and, you know, the fact is that generally speaking, when everybody turns on their hose,
right.
there's not enough water or not enough pressure in the system, and that's what happens in these big fires, is that firefighters run out of water.
Right.
Because everybody's got the water on trying to put out a fire. There's just not enough water in the system to be able to save all the houses.
So if you want to save your house, what you need to do is you need to do the basic things like create a barrier or a distance between your house and the nearest tree, and you need
yep.
to get rid of the certain types. So really quickly run through like the top five things, do it today so that when there is a fire coming, you can pick up your propane tank, not leave it behind to blow up, and hop in your car and drive away long before the fire shows up and feel like you actually protected your house. What are the top five things?
Top five things? Well, don't build a wood house with these cedar shake shingles and a lot of the ornamental. Make sure that your house is fairly clear of trees. A lot of people like to have trees overhanging their house. Don't put your propane barbecue on a wooden deck beside the house.
Mm-hmm.
If you can, don't build a wooden fence. I mean, I'm talking about areas that are really vulnerable to fire.
Right.
It probably does not apply to a lot of places in Washington mm-hmm. State, but I think that...
we don't know what the future is going to hold, though. So if I'm going to put
You're absolutely right there.
Yeah.
I guess the analogy here is that, you know, in places like Oklahoma, which is a tornado zone, people have a methodology to deal with when, you know, they've got early warning systems in place, where people should go, where they should hunker down. They've got a really clear idea of what to do when there's a tornado coming. We also have a similar situation in places like Florida and Louisiana for hurricanes.
Right. And a tsunami.
We're not so good at it when it comes to wildfire. It's
right.
still kind of a chaotic response. You look at Australia, for example, they have a code red, orange, yellow system. And when it goes to code red, every school knows what to do with those school kids. Hospitals know what to do in response to that. We don't really have a system like that in place in North America right now on a comprehensive level. So
right.
what happens in, say, a fire like Fort McMurray is, you know, the schools were evacuating. Parents didn't know where their kids were. They were mm-hmm. bringing in school buses, but they didn't know really where to take the kids because there's no real muster zone that was put into place. The evacuation of the hospital was heroic. But it was also chaotic.
Mm-hmm.
Then what do you do with the elderly that aren't as mobile? Remember Fort McMurray, which is an oil sands town, it's not a place where people go to retire. So the demographics were in favor of a younger population, more mobile, that could get the heck out of there quickly.
Right.
We've got to be cognizant of the fact that a lot of these people who are living in the forested areas are elderly people who are going to their little heaven,
right.
And they're not as mobile.
Right.
And we just don't have a system in place to provide them with early alerts. We're seeing it in some places, I know, but it's usually after a big fire that causes a lot of damage. We've got to do it for everybody now.
And I would imagine I know some young people who have ideas of basically finding a beautiful place in a forested region where their view is to, you know, protect the forest, to live sustainably, and to basically not engage in the style of life that has created these huge problems that we're facing. So I would think for someone like that, I would say, you know what, please just make sure that you know where or that you choose to place yourself somewhere close to a local, nearby, sustainable wetland so that if and when, you know, a fire comes through where you are, you know, if you can't get in a car and drive miles and miles away to some city or something, you know, but at least you can get to the wetland along with all the other animals, right?
Yeah.
All right.
Don't drain the wetland because it has mosquitoes.
Yeah, right. Oh, my gosh, good point. And, okay, so, Ed, we're at the end of our time together. One last thing that you really want to share with everyone?
You know, I think we just have to learn to live with fire. It's always going to be on the landscape. It's probably going to get a lot more intense. So I think we've got to start looking at it as a weather phenomenon, like hurricanes and tornadoes and even earthquakes, is that we've got to start preparing for these events better than we have up until now.
And that's the action piece. So action is the antidote to despair is a Joan Baez quote that I have on my email signature line. So
a great one.
Yeah. Yeah. One for the future. All right. Well, Edward, gosh, thank you so much for calling in today and helping to cover all these topics with us.
I enjoyed it.
And that, folks, is our show today. You have been listening to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose with me, your host, March Twisdale, here on Voice of Vashon 101.9 FM, KVSH.